Welcome to the Superfund Research Program Risk E-Learning Webinar Series on Risk Communication Strategies to Reduce Exposures and Improve Health. This is Session 4, Communication Toolkits to Communicate Environmental Risks. My name is Demia Wright, and I'm a public health educator in the Worker Training Program of the Division of Extramural Research and Training at NIEHS. I will be moderating today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items to ensure everyone understands how to participate in today's live session. When you registered for today's seminar, you should have received a confirmation email with instructions to join us for the live event. We also sent these same details in a reminder email yesterday. Those emails will both point you to the seminar homepage. The link to the homepage is on this slide. The seminar homepage is active from today forward, so I encourage you to save it as there are important pieces of information, including the session description, biographical information for our presenters, links to download presentation materials, as well as options to browse through related websites. There is even an option to provide feedback after our live delivery. Remember, this link will be available from today forward. This session is being hosted using Zoom webinar. For those already familiar with Zoom meetings, you should find this a very similar interface. You may join us for the live event using either the Zoom app on your computer or mobile device or via a web browser. Audio will be available online with your device speakers or headphones. You may also listen by telephone. Please use the join audio options in the lower left of the Zoom interface to select your preferred method of listening. Remember to check your local volume settings to adjust your audio as needed. Regardless of how you listen, all participants in our webinar will automatically be muted. Should you have any technical difficulties joining us on Zoom, we do have options to download the presentation materials and simply listen by phone. However, we encourage you to try to join us online for the fully interactive experience through Zoom whenever possible. We will not be using the chat feature in today's webinar. Instead, if you have a question, comment, or need to report any technical issues, please use the Q&A pod. You can use that window to privately submit feedback at any time. Closed captioning is available for this webinar. Please use the closed caption button in the lower toolbar to access subtitles. Also remember that our session today is being recorded. You will receive an email after our live delivery when the recording becomes available so that you can watch it back on demand. Lastly, I encourage you to stay with us until the very end of the program. We will cover a number of important reminders, such as how to share your feedback on this webinar and how to print out a certificate of participation. With those brief reminders, let's take a quick look at the Zoom webinar interface. First, in the lower left, you will find audio controls, which will allow you to select and adjust your preferred method for listening to today's session. In the main or central portion of your screen, you will be able to view presentation materials. In the far right of your screen, you'll be able to view our presenters and moderators. In the upper right corner, you will have options to enlarge the presentation or go into full screen mode. On the bottom middle of your screen, you should see the toolbar I mentioned earlier, which has options to access the live closed captioning as well as the Q&A. Please note when you press the Q&A button, it will open a new separate window. I encourage you to rearrange or move this window around on your screen for the optimum placement so that you may enter questions at any time while viewing the presentations. There are options in that new Q&A window to anonymously ask questions. If you do not check the button to send anonymously, your name will be visible with your message to our event moderator. This presentation has been provided as part of a U.S. Environmental Protection Agency webinar. The document does not constitute EPA policy. Mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute endorsement or recommendation for use. Links to non-EPA websites do not imply any official EPA endorsement of or responsibility for the opinions, ideas, data, or products presented at those locations or guarantee the validity of the information provided. Links to non-EPA servers are provided solely as a pointer to information that might be useful to EPA staff and the public. And finally, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot your problem. This session is the fourth and final installment of the four-part Fall 2021 Risk E-Learning webinar series. If you missed the first two webinars, the recorded archives are now available on the CLUIN website. Recording from the third session will be available soon. Please refer to the links that have just been copied in the chat. This series builds on an SRP workshop held in June focused on risk communication strategies to reduce exposures and improve health. These webinars delve into many of the themes that came up during that workshop. SRP used feedback from the meeting to identify topics for the webinars that participants wanted to hear more about. The workshop website now includes links to a meeting report and workshop resources. The resources document not only includes publications that were referenced throughout the meeting, but also provides a nice compilation of communication tools and resources that were brought up during each session. Links to these resources have just been copied in the chat and are also available in the webinar homepage under related links. With that, we are ready to get started. First, we will hear from BJ Cummings and Dr. Lisa Hayward, who manage the Community Engagement Core and Research Translation Core at the University of Washington SRP Center. Dr. Hayward and Ms. Cummings, I will now turn it over to you.
Okay, can you see my slides?
Yes, they look great.
Wonderful, thank you. Hi, everybody. We are really honored to be included in today's webinar, and we'd like to acknowledge that we're joining you from the traditional lands of the Duwamish tribe and the Coast Salish people. And today we're gonna be talking about efforts to keep some of the traditional seafood resources from this area safe and healthy to eat, and strategies to protect the health of both our indigenous and immigrant consumers of these resources. As the Community Engagement Core for the UW Superfund Research Program, our primary focus is on providing both technical and engagement support for our nonprofit and community-based partners. In the case of this project, our primary partners were two nonprofit groups, the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, which is comprised in turn of 10 community-based and nonprofit organization members representing local tribal, neighborhood, and environmental stakeholders. And together they serve as the community advisory group for our Lower Duwamish Superfund site. And the other partner was Just Health Action, a nonprofit that works to promote health equity and environmental justice and build community capacity really around self-determination. So these two organizations developed an environmental justice driven fishing community capacity building program called Promotores several years ago. And DRCC led recruitment for the program, and Just Health Action was the lead for curriculum development and facilitation. Other partners for this project included the Promotores, community health advocates, that were part of that program, and several of our government agencies in this area that then adopted the Promotores program and institutionalized it as part of EPA and our local public health agencies' institutional controls program for the fishing community on the Duwamish. And if you're not familiar with institutional controls, we can dive into that a little bit more later, but basically strategies and tools for protecting the fishing community while the Superfund site is being cleaned up. And there were, we also pulled in the State Department of Health and, or sorry, the State Fish and Wildlife Department and a couple other nonprofit partners that we can discuss more later. So the objectives of this project, which was a video series, were co-developed in collaboration with all of our community and agency partners. The first objective was to protect people's health by discouraging consumption of resident or non-salmon fish in the Duwamish River. And the Department of Health for Washington State had issued a zero consumption advisory for all of the river's resident seafood. So this was a primary objective behind the project. However, the river's fishers are generally low-income, both native and immigrant fishers who rely on the river's fish for both subsistence and cultural fishing practices that are also important to their health. So objective number two was to promote healthy alternatives. We do have a health advisory on our salmon, but they are less contaminated than our resident fish that live in the river throughout their lives. And we were working with the community health advocates to develop strategies for shifting focus from other species onto salmon and how to prepare fish for and stay within the bounds of the law when fishing for salmon. And that third objective was really important because being fined and jailed for members of these communities is also very unhealthy. And then finally, there was a very direct response from the to the community health advocates who identified videos in particular as their preferred tool of communication. So why videos? Basically, they said they were a much more inclusive tool than many of the written materials that were being circulated at the time, fishing signs and flyers and things like that, much more accessible, could reach much more of the community, was very easy to do in a multilingual format that was both inclusive and accessible. They could really kind of cover all the bases, all the information that they wanted to without losing people's attention. So they were able to be more comprehensive in the information that they wanted to convey with this approach. And they felt that it would have much greater reach more people and more diverse groups of people than the written materials were. So really briefly, we wound up with a series of 9 videos, which was more than originally anticipated, but that was because of additional needs that were being identified and requested by the fishing community members as we went through the project. Both the how to fish and the how to stay out of jail aspects really needed to be fleshed out. The project was initially done in 4 languages, Spanish, Vietnamese, Khmer for the Cambodian community, and English, and additional languages are being and will be added. And then there's also has been a goal to do evaluation of the impact. And so far we've been able to take a look at the impact on the reach most effectively. And that's been very positive so far. One of our partners is also doing some evaluation on impact. We undertook this, as mentioned, as a co-produced project. So all of our academic, government, and community partners participated in every step of the project. We, UWSRP, contracted with a university-based program as our videographer and production consultant. And at each step of the way, working with that consultant, the team shared, drafts of scripts, storyboards, rough cuts, circulated and got feedback from each of the partners at each step along the way, rather than kind of a small group producing it and then getting feedback on the near final product. It was co-produced throughout. And once completed, we're seeing the videos being used in the community as predicted by some, and also by some new folks that are out there using it. The community health advocates themselves, who helped produce the series, are using the videos in their role as CHAs, community health advocates, implementing EPA's formal institutional controls program for the fishing community. And they are now contracted to do that. So it has been institutionalized into the EPA and our local public health agency as an overall program, and the videos have become part of that. So that has been just terrific to see institutionalized in that way. It is also being used by the community advisory group, DRCC, they have links on their website and are using it when they do education and outreach and advocacy work on behalf of the fishing community. And then one of the new groups that has emerged that is using it quite extensively is a youth-led social media educational program called Juntos Podemos Cuidar Nuestro Rio Duwamish, or Together We Can Take Care of Our Duwamish River. And these folks were planning on actually setting up video tables, stations in the local bait and tackle shops when COVID hit. So that's how they were planning on using it and still do in the future, but they were able to pivot and do webinar-based programming using the videos. And they actually paid members of the fishing community to attend in lieu of being able to provide them with food and childcare and those things that were gonna happen at the bait and tackle shops. And they have brought in experts, both from within our program and others, to participate in those webinars as well and help answer people's questions. So that's been really fun to see. I wanted to give you a little quick taste of what the program looks like, what the videos look like. So there's a short montage that I think I can start right here on the screen. Hopefully this will play well.
We are all here to work for the same purpose, which is to inform our community about the contamination in the Duwamish River.
Hi, I'm looking to buy a fishing license. Can you help me with that?
I sure can. Have you ever bought one?
Pretty good.
Really, y'all, I don't got it.
So that's what it looks like. And as I said, it's divvied up into nine, you know, short, kind of easy to consume bits. There are a number of things that I think we can count as successes from this project. One of them is that, you know, in addition to the folks who helped co-develop it and plan to use it, it is now being used by new community-based partners as well. So it's really great to see it kind of multiplying out there. It's had really excellent reach so far, despite the COVID restrictions. Some of the nine videos, you know, like the recipe ones, may only have a few hundred views, but some of the foundational ones have between 5,000 and 10,000 views. So that's been really great to see. And of course, that it's been institutionalized into EPA's fishing IC program is really important. So there have also been some challenges with this. There was some confusion and disagreement about some of the key health messages that we needed to resolve, particularly things around the balance between, you know, encouraging and discouraging fish consumption and balancing, you know, health benefits and health risks and making sure that we got those messages right. And then there were also some of our beginning community partners that we needed to restore towards the end of the program, because some of them had been contracted by the local public health agency to work on this. And when those contracts ended or were terminated, we at UW didn't realize that they were no longer in the loop. So we had to kind of come back around at the end, and it delayed the completion of the project, because as we got new feedback, when we thought we were nearly done, we got new feedback from those who had been left out and needed to go back and make some changes. So we were able to correct that in the end. But as a result, a few lessons learned before shifting over to Lisa. Really important to make sure that all the key messages have buy-in from the whole group at the beginning and at check-ins throughout the project. So I think finding ways to formalize that, make sure that they're written down, you know, that everybody signs off on them and still has the flexibility to revisit new questions that come up in kind of a formalized way, I think would have been very helpful. And also, of course, paying close attention to particularly the community-based organization's role, presence and role in every stage of production is very, very important. And I think we all know that. One of the things that we have started to institutionalize as a result of this is written partnership agreements. It can be as formal as an MOU or just a written agreement among all of the partners, and we're trying to make that standard practice in our CAC at this point. And then even with all of that planning, super important, of course, to stay flexible. One example of that is right at the end when we thought we were finished and wanted to do one last review with everybody. At that point, the videos were subtitled. And I think I just asked a simple question of, you know, why did you choose subtitles instead of dubbing? And the answer was that, well, actually dubbing would be better. So we had to go back and redo everything for those members of it to make it more accessible to the community, because there are some folks in the community who aren't even literate, you know, in their native language, or they just thought it would be more accessible if there was, if it were spoken rather than people having to read it. So all of the planning in the world does not erase the need to stay flexible. Some of these lessons learned we carried forward into our next work with one of our research teams that's related to fishing, and Lisa's going to pick up and talk from there.
Thanks, BJ. So I'm switching gears to talk about our UW SRP Project 4 and the risk communication efforts with this project are not as far along, but it's a good opportunity for us to apply some of those lessons learned that BJ outlined. So I'm just going to start, BJ, can you just go back one slide? I'm just going to start with an introduction of the main players of this project. So on the previous slide, there's Jim Gowell, a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Engineering at UW-Tacoma, Dr. Becca Newman, a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and her student Samantha Fung. So those are the SRP investigators. And then as their project has gotten more multidisciplinary, they've also begun, next slide now, to collaborate more closely with Julian Olden, who's a fish biologist, and Alex Horner-Devine, who specializes in sedimentation. So it's their work that I present today. And one of the most important lessons I think that BJ has highlighted, I'm going to reiterate, is to involve partners early on and involve them throughout. And so this lets them know what you plan to do up front. It gives them a chance to inform your approach, which can be really helpful. Collaborate with the experiment sometimes, keeps them updated as you have findings to report. And then probably most importantly, it just helps build the trust that you need to have in place when it comes time to communicate the risk or to devise policy and intervention strategies. So next slide. For this project, investigators worked with all the agency partners listed here and then some. This was advantageous in so many ways, in some ways that couldn't have been anticipated. For example, early on, the team needed to set up a big pole that they called the Maypole in the middle of a lake. And because of the contamination, UW wouldn't allow divers to come out and help without hazmat suits. It was prohibitive. But EPA, on the other hand, they had the hazmat suits and they were happy to help as a training exercise for their crews. So I'm sorry I didn't include the pictures because they're out there and they look like they're in lunar landing suits, which actually raised an issue with the community. The investigators needed to get a message out to the lake residents to warn them about what was going on, because it looked alarming to see these people in hazmat suits in a lake that's typically used for recreational swimming right in their backyards. Next slide. So talking about those lake residents, that brings me to another set of critical partners, the potentially impacted communities. In this case, the lake associations that are comprised of people living around the lakes were considered the most important early on. Jim and his team made a point of presenting regularly at lake association meetings and writing articles about the project for lake association newsletters. After the Maypole was installed, it turned out that the lake residents were unhappy with how it looked. So the team had the equipment modified to be less visually obtrusive. After that, and after some regular updates, residents seemed to feel more invested in the work being done and even be protective of the equipment when there were other boaters around, for example. So the municipalities listed at the bottom provided access to boat ramps that are closed seasonally and help keep the team updated on local events of potential relevance for the project, like annual hydroplane races. So now just a little bit of scientific context. Next slide. So Jim Gall got to Tacoma and identified the potential contamination in some local lakes because he knew about the former smelter that was there. And when he bought his house, he was given warnings about lead and arsenic in the soil. But when he measured arsenic and published his first paper, that was really the first report of contamination in these lakes in this area. So after establishing that arsenic was there, the next step was to examine patterns of contamination, both spatially and temporally, that could tie the contamination to pollution from the Asarco smelter, which is a Superfund site. And when he sampled arsenic in the water column, he found that it was especially elevated in Lake Killarney, which is this shallow lake with high arsenic in its sediments. And that was a surprise because people had previously thought that arsenic would stay mostly in the sediments at the bottom of the lake. And that's kind of a whole separate story. But basically, out of that work, there's the realization that arsenic is inorganic arsenic getting into this oxygenated water where the plants and animals hang out. So the question was then posed, is this posing a risk to human health or ecological health? And chemically, arsenic resembles phosphorus, and phosphorus is often a limiting nutrient in freshwater systems. So for that reason, it's very possible and even expected that plants can take it up in contaminated lakes like these. Next slide. So the team started looking at plants and periphyton, and periphyton is this mix of algae, cyanobacteria, fungi, detritus. It's that fuzzy green stuff that grows on surfaces that are underwater in lakes. And they sampled it almost by accident because they brought in plants to sample and they came with some periphyton. And when they looked at the periphyton, the levels of arsenic were many times higher, maybe an order of magnitude higher. So they started thinking about the animals that might eat the periphyton, primary among them, this snail in the middle. And for those of you that don't recognize this species, this is a Chinese mystery snail. So it was imported from Asia to the Pacific Northwest as actually a food crop, if you can call it that. And it's eaten by Asian communities. So the snails eat the periphyton. Other organisms we know are being eaten. There's crayfish. There's Julian Olden holding some crayfish. And there's sunfish, too. So the next step was to go out and sample these animals. And what did they find? They found arsenic. They found arsenic in lake animals from every lake studied, including Pine and Bonney lakes, which were included as uncontaminated reference lakes. So they used the EPA values for average consumption rates and three different thresholds for cancer risk to illustrate the potential risks to human health. And that's what you see here, with the highest risks in red. You can see that snails are unhealthy to eat in all but the most permissive scenario in the cleanest lake. Consumption of crayfish and sunfish from Lake Killarney are also associated with health risk. So these are the results that the team presented to their agency partners last fall in a meeting that they planned to precede the community partner meeting that they planned to precede the publication of the results. They didn't want anyone to be taken by surprise. One very important outcome of that agency meeting was to come to a consensus about messaging. This is definitely a lesson learned from the video project. Our team could say, this is what we plan to say to community partners, and agency partners could say, this part of your message concerns us. And then those areas of disagreement or differing emphasis could be resolved so that everyone was on the same page with how the information would be presented to community. Another important outcome was to get help translating these results into better risk communication terms. After the agency meeting, both Washington Department of Health and Seattle King County Public Health offered to help turn these results into meal limits. Those are a much more concrete way to think about risk and probably more helpful for lake users. So next slide. This table shows the results of those meal limit calculations, also separated into three categories based on acceptable risk. And that's because different agencies use different thresholds for acceptable risk when it comes to cancer risk. And so it's good to look at all of them. The boxes shaded in gray show foods that pose a health risk at average rates of consumption. You can see that eating snails or crawfish from any of these lakes is associated with risk. Eating sunfish from any lake also raises flags, at least at the most protective level of cancer risk. So what comes next? Next slide. Despite all the efforts to engage potentially affected communities at the outset of the study, the team recognizes that the community members they have engaged to date are not necessarily the community members that are most important to engage with this information, meaning that the people who live in lakeshore homes are not the people most likely to be eating animals from these lakes. The lakes also have areas for public access, and many people visit them to fish and recreate. So that's the first question. Who's eating these lake animals? And how can we best engage them? Those questions are lumped together here, but each is huge and represents its own ambitious effort. Ideally, we'd be able to identify lake users and then involve them in the risk communication efforts, as was done in the video project, so as to maximize the chances of influencing behavior and ultimately improving public health, much the way BJ described. Progress has been made toward answering this first question. Jim got a $10,000 grant last year as a UW Tacoma Community Engagement Fellow, and he recently completed a pilot study with his students surveying lake users at 13 different lakes in the region. So that's a great start, although there's definitely more work to be done. So what levels of arsenic are in other fish? This is a question that Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife wanted to know about once they heard the team's results. So they went out in August with the team and caught additional species not included in the previous study. And those species are currently being analyzed by our team for arsenic. And then what about arsenic in other lakes? This is a good question for Washington, given that levels in the reference lakes were high enough so that eating snails was found to be a health risk at every threshold. And Washington has a legacy of applying arsenic to apple orchards and other agricultural products so that it might be possible to find heavily contaminated lakes nowhere near a center. So after, or even while learning more about who is at risk in terms of who is eating animals from the lakes and how and what species contain arsenic in which lakes, then it's all about applying the lessons learned that BJ has highlighted. So the number one lesson, I think, is that the risk communication efforts should be informed by the potentially affected communities. Can't really emphasize that enough. It's not enough to put up signs, even multilingual signs. Some lake users may not be literate, for example. We learned that or had that emphasized to us. That was one reality that informed our work on the video project. Another lesson is that risk communication should be conducted in collaboration with agency partners from the outset. You certainly don't want to be inadvertently putting out messages that conflict with one another. So hopefully that will save time in the long run, because as we learned with the fishing videos, developing the right communication tools can be a big investment, both of time and of money. So hopefully some of this will be useful to you in your own risk communication efforts. And we want to thank Sarah and Molly for the invitation to present, and to all of you for your time and attention today. We're happy to take questions.
That was fantastic. Thank you very much for those presentations. We've had lots of good questions come in. I'm going to start off with a couple questions for BJ. So first, how did you identify what languages to translate? If there were more than the chosen languages spoken in the community, what factors did you consider to pick those languages?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So the Duwamish River Cleanup Coalition, which is the community advisory group for the site, had been raising concerns for the river's primarily immigrant fishing communities for several years as we went through the remedial investigation and feasibility study for the Superfund site. And one of the things that emerged from those concerns being raised and those questions being asked throughout that process was that we needed more information on who was actually fishing in the rivers, kind of the effort that Jim is just now starting on the arsenic contaminated lakes. So there was actually an addendum to the remedial investigation and feasibility study that was called the Fisher Study for the Duwamish. And there was a really well-designed, you know, with everybody's input, fishing survey done, and it took a couple of years. It was done in multiple languages. As new languages were encountered in the fishing community, new languages were added to the survey, to the capacities of the survey team. Community-based organizations were contracted to do the survey, so they weren't being done by government officials, folks that might have made folks a little bit more nervous. A lot of youth were also used, young people. There's youth programs in the Duwamish Valley that were tapped to help. So between the community-based kind of known neighbors and community members and youth doing the surveys and collecting the information, we were able to get a really good picture of not how many people were fishing, but who was out fishing, what languages did they speak, what nationalities and ethnicities did they represent, what were they fishing for specifically, what were they doing with those fish, were they just eating them themselves, were they sharing them with friends and family and neighbors. So we got a really nice picture of what was, how that resource was being used in a variety of fishing communities. And as a result of that survey, we were able to identify the top three or four language groups and that was a little bit more of a numbers game. We encountered more people who spoke Spanish, Vietnamese, and Khmer than spoke, a dozen other languages that were included in the survey. But as time goes on, the public health agency and the community health advocates are trying to add those additional language needs into the institutional control program.
Great, thank you. And just a reminder to everyone that you can submit questions using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. Another question for you, BJ. Can you explain more on how you resolve confusion on balancing risks and benefits of eating fish?
So the issue that we ran into was given that the overall strategy was to try to shift folks from eating resident fish to eating salmon. The issue that we ran into is how much do we want to emphasize the health risks of eating salmon that also had an advisory on them? And because we hadn't addressed that question directly up front, we knew what we were doing strategically and we knew why, and so we thought we were aligned in objectives, but there was a difference of opinion in the team as to whether or not we should or wanted to directly communicate the salmon advisory as well. And so we had to kind of stop, and I would say it took a couple of months to resolve, because we kept pulling in additional partners to help advise us and to help clarify what the advisory meant and didn't mean. And we finally wound up with all of the partners, in a meeting at ATSDR, with everybody weighing in at the highest levels. Before we could come to consensus on what that salmon health advisory should look like in the context of the objective for this project. So we added additional partners and kept going, kept reaching out and kind of going higher and higher for advice and clarification.
Great. For Lisa, there was a question. You mentioned the smelter in the area that may have contributed to the lead and arsenic contamination in the area's soil and lakes. Was the potentially responsible party identified and engaged in the research and public outreach efforts?
No, the ASARCO smelter was closed decades ago and the company sort of left. So as far as I know, they're not involved in any cleanup at this point.
And a question about the hazmat suits and being concerned of the people being afraid of them because they usually are in, having recreation in the lake. So was it just the sediment that was a concern? How was it that they were able to have recreation in the lake at the same time you're concerned with contamination?
Yeah, the sediment is definitely a concern. And we didn't talk about that component of the project here, but they're worried about kids who play in the sand along the lakeshore and end up with sand in their mouth. That's definitely a problem. Swimming is probably not as big a problem for people, but it is good for everyone to be aware about the sediments. And then I think it's just the occupational health requirements that people wear those hazmat suits when they go out on the job to install the equipment.
Yeah. Great. And what is a maypole?
It's I wish I had a picture. And I I should have modified my slides. I didn't know we could share them today. But it's a big pole. It's got these guy wires. I wish Jim were here to describe it better. And then sampling devices can move up and down to sample different parts of the water column, get the oxygenated water and anaerobic water at the bottom. Oh, so
interesting.
Yeah. It definitely has a presence in the lake.
Yeah, I'm sure. BJ, there's a couple of technical questions about the videos. For example, what type of camera and video editing software did you use? And maybe how long did it take to make the videos and what was its cost?
I can't answer the technical questions about the camera and editing equipment, but I'm happy to find out and message anyone directly, get that information to anyone directly. This was a big undertaking for us. The project took about 2 years in all, and final price tag, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. It's been a year or so since we closed this out. I wanna say that it got up around 50,000, Lisa, am I exaggerating that?
I was going to say 30, but I was also going to say, listen to BJ and not to me.
I think perhaps with our staff time, we were trying to figure out what the cost was, but I think the out-of-pocket cost was more like 30. So not a small undertaking, but which is part of why we're really encouraged to see the various ways in which it's being used and that it seems to be reaching a lot of people. But it was a really important project for us. For 20 years now, we've really been prioritizing working with the fishing communities on the river. And I think this was the first really tangible, direct project that we were able to develop, co-produced with them. So it was an important one.
I mean, you could tell the videos were really high quality, just even, the short that we saw. And they're public, there's web links that you can provide.
Yeah, and in fact, I can go ahead and pull the link from our website and throw it up in the chat in just a moment here.
Okay. And for Lisa, let's see, there's a question on, could some of the arsenic in your area be naturally occurring, e.g. from geological formations? And they're saying in Canada, they have naturally occurring geological arsenic that has caused public concern in groundwater.
Certainly, yeah. And Jim would definitely say that. It might be that that's all we're seeing in Pine and Bonnie Lakes. It's just the naturally occurring arsenic.
Still researching that.
Yeah.
And then in the Lake Killarney samples, did you find much lead or other heavy metals such as cadmium? And if so, do you plan on looking at combined health lists?
That's a really good question. I've never asked Jim that question, so I don't know. I can't answer it.
Scrolling. Let's see. Where am I? Let's see. One more question. Can you expand on the characterization of just bumped around? I think it's of A's in the water column and sediments. That's the arsenic. Was the arsenic detected in the dissolve phase in the lake water or just total arsenic?
I know they did speciation, and I know that the inorganic arsenic is there, and it sort of declines as you move up the food chain, the opposite of the bioaccumulation. But that's really all I can tell you about the specifics of the chemistry.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and we're going to move on to the next presentation now.
Thanks.
Thank you. And next we will hear from Dr. Julia Brody, who's Executive Director and Senior Scientist at Silent Spring Institute, and Dr. Phil Brown, a Professor of Sociology and Health Science and Research Translation Coordinator and Co-Director of the Community Engagement Core at the Northeastern University SRP Center. So Dr. Brody and Dr. Brown, I will now turn it over to you.
Good afternoon. Am I coming through?
Yes, you sound good.
We acknowledge the territory where we stand is the traditional land of the Massachusetts and Wampanoag people. Our team is very proud to have been working on this issue for nearly 20 years, and it represents the work of many people and organizations. And you'll hear a lot about those different groups and people over this presentation. Our dozens of articles report on this in all its phases, and on our last slide, we'll have a link so you can find those articles. What I'm going to do is start by providing background and history and context for our report back work, and then Julie will walk you through the practical aspects of doing this. So first of all, why is this an equity issue? Our work grew up thoroughly in the milieu of environmental justice and CBPR, and we developed our ethical, scientific, and communitarian aspects of report back from very deep involvement in those frameworks. And the truth is, we were often a very lonely voice at the beginning, and we're now glad to have been joined by so many other people. And we're certainly so happy to have this vehicle today. Research ethics have been very important to environmental health for a long time. And for us, it means that we are respecting the autonomy of study participants and finding ways that this research benefits them. Research should not simply benefit researchers. It should benefit the people whose communities are involved in it. Many of you, of course, are familiar with environmental health literacy, which NIEHS has promoted so well and written about so well, and that provides an opportunity for culturally competent communication in so many ways. And again, the research is not just for us, it's for everybody, and therefore knowledge is not just in its own right, knowledge is power. And what we think of usually as the right to know is simply not enough. It has to be even further than that, what we have called the research right to know. And most importantly, the right to act. People have to be able to use this research to act to improve their environmental and other life circumstances. So one of the things that's important to us is that EJ and other community groups really like report back. It fits so well with their approach to community ownership of data. It supports their belief that research should lead to action, as I said previously, and it develops community capacity. There were always funds in our projects to hire and to train community organization members to do the work. It facilitates the production of community-driven tools, things that people can use. Sometimes they are DIY kits, sometimes there are other civic science approaches, but community-driven tools, even if they're very technical monitoring devices, are things that are produced together, co-production with communities and researchers. It was very interesting when this project started. At first, it was reporting back to people on the household exposure study on Cape Cod. We expanded that to Richmond, California, and to Bolinas, California. And we worked together with an EJ group called Communities for Better Environment. And that was a very important thing because they identified a lot of things that we would not have otherwise identified. We were very interested in endocrine-disrupting compounds. They also were very interested in metals and in particulate matter related to the Chevron refinery that had been a target of their organizing efforts for many years. So a lot of things changed as we moved ahead. And those groups wanted the report back to help them use that information to deal with the refinery's request for expansion. Also, because we were working with one EJ group on our connection between breast cancer research and advocacy and EJ, that brought in other EJ groups, Concerned Citizens of Tillery, North Carolina, that have been working a lot on hog farms, and We Act for Environmental Justice in New York. And that was very important to us to see that other EJ groups were now taking up some of these same kinds of issues. Our current study, one of our many current studies, the REACH study, is looking at PFAS immunotoxicity. And there we're working with community groups testing for peas in New Hampshire at the Peas Trade Port in Portsmouth and the Massachusetts Breast Cancer Coalition. They're partners, but so are many other grassroots PFAS groups around the country. And I mean literally dozens of these who are now working with us to help put together medical guidance documents and maps and ways to do report back of data either from water or from blood. What's important for me, of course, as a sociologist, is to bring in the social science elements. And Silent Spring and our team have had a lot of work together here. We have started this whole idea of the exposure experience, taking an idea from medical sociology, which really centers the person's experience of disease as an illness that relates to their whole life experience, their work, their family, and everything culturally in their lives. And so taking that into account has enabled us to see how they respond to exposure, how they relate it to their own known and potential causes of disease. And also, we wrote another article on research altruism because we've been continually both surprised and very glad that there are so many people who want to do this research with us, so many communities that we are sometimes even inundated with requests to be part of studies as volunteers, even when trying to do randomized studies. So one of the things that we've done in our work on social science is to collaborate on, I think, the only NIEHS T32 program, training program, that looks at the particular combination of social science and environmental health. We also had a conference grant to work on this in 2014. We had a wonderful conference on that topic, and that became a special issue of New Solutions. Keynote speakers there were Gudgie Cook from the Akwesasne Mohawk community and Gwen Coleman from NIEHS. And we certainly encourage you to look at that issue to get a lot of the things we're talking to you about today. So the last thing I want to talk about are some very specific issues that come up with IRBs, because the work that we are doing with Report Back started, as I say, about two decades ago. And I was at that time at Brown, and the IRB was very resistant. Very few people were doing Report Back in those days. And they were concerned that what we were doing was going to be violating confidentiality simply because we had continuing contact with participants, which is actually totally the opposite of what CBPR is, where you are always trying to deepen that engagement, not trying to attenuate it. They didn't like the idea we were going to have public meetings and talk about these things with people. Again, the essence of what we're meaning by all the work that we do. And they wanted us to destroy data, which is really ridiculous because we believe the community owns that data. So how can the university come in and tell the community to destroy it? We had experience with our colleagues at BU who did a breast milk study. And while they were allowed to do report back, and of course, we eventually succeeded. We had to educate our IRB at Brown. But at the BU IRB, they didn't want it to be for the researchers to go out and do it in an active way. They wanted it to be passive. So while we got 100% virtually of people saying, yes, we want that data, when the researchers had to wait around for a phone call from the participants, they didn't call back. And that was because they weren't going to make that extra step to call up Dr. So-and-so at a university that might be a step more than they were used to. We worked with our colleagues at Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and this is the title of the article we did with them, because they also had a deep amount of trouble with the IRB there that not only didn't want them to report back about breast milk containing PCBs, but didn't even want them to do the research because they felt that it was going to make people not breastfeed. And yet every single tribe in the area that they were working on wrote letters saying they wanted to do it. So that's the kind of things that you face. And there are so many other things about IRBs. They aren't monolithic. They aren't all following the same set of rules. There may be a very small set of rules in the federal regulations. Every university acts on them differently. So what we've learned is that you have to really educate them. You have to show them what other IRBs have come along and done. And you have to make sure community partners really push to make this a very important thing for them to understand. So hopefully that context will let you now see the kinds of things that Julie is going to show you.
Okay, I'm going to jump in now and talk more about the practical aspects and what goes into actually making a report with that contextual background from Phil. Thank you. So our approach is built on participatory research from beginning to end. We start with multidisciplinary teams that are partnered with community-based organizations, as Phil was describing. So our teams include expertise in toxicology and epidemiology, but also psychology, sociology, communications, and computer science. At this point, we've conducted about several hundred interviews with participants and also interviewed researchers and IRB representatives, and held focus groups, advisory councils, and stakeholder workshops, and observations at community meetings where personal exposure reports are being disseminated. When we develop a new report, it goes through a one-on-one user testing to see whether it's doing what we expected and how well it's being received and understood. And now that we have digital reports, we can use analytics to see how long people are spending on their reports, what information they navigate to, and how, in what order, and how long they spend there. So this is the input to the reports that I'm going to be talking to you about. We found over about 20 years of doing research on this that when people want their results, they don't just want a number. They want a great deal of contextual information. They want to know what we found, how much, do we think that's high, is it safe, where did it come from, and especially what should they do about it. And so to provide personalized reports with this kind of contextual information, we developed DERBY, the Digital Exposure Report Back Interface. It's a software framework for generating personalized reports for computer, smartphone, or print, and it's scalable to studies of all sizes. In our first reports, we were cut and pasting sentences to personalized reports for each participant, and this automates that process and makes it much more feasible to do personalized reports in large studies. We've developed now a researcher dashboard for authoring reports. Some of you have tried it in its alpha or beta versions, and we're looking for new collaborators all the time who might be interested in being early testers of the researcher dashboard that allows other teams to use DERBY to make reports for their own studies. So reports begin with a welcome page that orients people to the study that they were in and what to expect from their report. Then they get an individual login. There is no personally identifiable information in the report, so it doesn't contain overt personal identifiers. Each person has their own access code to see only their report. And from this, once they've logged in, people will navigate to a summary page that has main messages and that we call headlines about their individual results, as well as community-wide results for the study that they participated in. So this is an example of a personal summary page. Here's an example of a headline: your sample at a higher level of a bisphenol than 95% of Americans. So this person happens to be an outlier compared with the NHANES data. Another type of headline might compare the person to the study. So your sample at a lower level of a sunscreen chemical than most others in the study. Or it could be just detect, non-detect, a flame retardant chemical was detected in your sample. Then from here, people typically will link to details about their headline. And there they'll find their headline repeated in more detail. And then comes contextual information about the sources, the health effects, and strategies for exposure reduction. DERBY now contains a large library of this kind of information about many different chemicals. And researchers can either use the information from the DERBY library, or they can modify it to say what they want to say. Then people will scroll down to graphs of their own results. We use graphs to use visual abilities to communicate the gist of the results, independent of numeracy and literacy. So in this top graph for PFAS, this, again, is an outlier individual. You can readily see that this person is quite far above the U.S. median. One of the great things about the digital reports is that you can hover over parts of the graph, get graph reading tips and numerical details about your results. The reports also include answers to common questions. Again, there's a library of these and researchers can create their own, and contact information so participants can contact a researcher to get help interpreting their results. There are many different places in the reports where we're communicating fundamental messages that support environmental health literacy and communicate transparently about the uncertainty for the endocrine disruptors that are the usual topics of our studies. So for example, these are some examples of messages. Chemicals in this study have been detected at different levels in people throughout the US. So we don't want to normalize having pollutants in your body, but we do want to let people know that they're not alone. So far, studies of people have found that higher levels of PFAS are linked to increased cholesterol levels, decreased vaccine response in children, and so on. Based on what we know now, we can't link your results to specific health concerns for you or your family. We have found that people do understand this message, that you can't make a direct link from your results to illnesses. In Silent Spring Institute reports, we always include knowledge from epidemiology and from animal and cell studies, and we explain this. Since we don't do experiments on people, we often learn how chemicals may affect health by testing in animals or cells, similar to the way we test new drugs for safety. Our latest reports are in smartphone format, including for the Protect Superfund project, where we first deployed our smartphone prototype. We now have reports in the field for two ECHO cohorts, Chemicals in Our Bodies and iKids. The content is the same. The navigation is a little bit more linear, but it does share with the computer-based reports the ability for the user to decide what information they want to see. So people can see a lot of detail or less detail. You see these learn more buttons that let people go to the level of detail they want. And similarly, there are chemicals pages, and then you can get expanded information about your graphs if you want it. People are particularly interested in information about how to reduce exposure, and this information is found on the chemicals pages, but you can also navigate to it directly in this What Can You Do page on both the phone and computer prototypes. We've found that the information about exposure reduction is of great interest, not just to study participants, but also to their family members and friends and community members. So we created a smartphone app called Detox Me, which is available for both Android and Apple phones, that includes this exposure reduction information. So I hope you'll try it and share it with others that you're in touch with. We've been especially focused lately on how to match the action tips to something that will really work in light of where the exposure is coming from. So we have exposures coming from polluters, from products that are hard to avoid, like an infant car seat. You can't really choose not to use that. Or products where there are individual choices, like home pesticides, which are easier to not use. That's the easy case scenario where you can advise people about products to not use or how to choose safer products. The polluters and the products that are hard to avoid really require collective action. Many products are not adequately labeled, so your choices may not be effective. And here you really need to help participants connect to collective action opportunities. And so that's the area that we've been working on lately. And we just recently conducted three focus groups of peripartum moms in the ECHO, Chemicals in Our Bodies and iKids cohorts, two in English, one in Spanish. And it was really very interesting to see that these moms were motivated to act to protect family health despite the time burdens of having new babies in the middle of a pandemic. And they readily built new ideas on their other experiences of civic participation on other issues. Given the burdens that they have in their own lives right now, they did ask for very concrete, time-conscious, straightforward information about how to reduce exposures and connect to civic action. So that's an area where we need to see how far can we go in getting concrete with tactics that we recommend. People expressed willingness to share their knowledge from their reports with their networks. I think this is a really important avenue to community level action. They were at the same time quite wary of advocating exposure reduction in settings such as with childcare providers, where they felt that they might be threatening a resource that was really important to them. So that's something we need to be sensitive to. Turning to our research on report back outcomes, what happens when people get their reports, we hear a great deal of gratitude. People thank us for the reports, appreciate the transparency. We find it increases trust in the research team. A great deal of learning takes place with major conceptual shifts about what are the sources of pollution. People are not aware that chemicals can go into products without testing for safety, for example, and they learn that from their personal exposure reports and studies that include consumer product chemicals. They begin naturally brainstorming about the exposure sources and exposure reduction. They do reflect on family illnesses, but they understand the uncertainty about that. So you'll hear people say, I wonder if this illness was linked to this chemical exposure, but I know I can't make that direct connection. And we see pride in contributing to science and community health. When people see their reports, they get a much fuller understanding of how their sample made a difference. People use their results to make personal choices about products. They take them to their doctors. And they have, some of our participants have engaged in policy change. Phil mentioned that study participants in the Northern California Household Exposure Study helped to win a court case to limit expansion of a Chevron refinery. We've seen public housing residents use reports to get better attention from doctors for their child's asthma. That was interesting to us to see that families in public housing felt that doctors were not paying attention to their child's symptoms, but when they brought this report, they got better care. In the Women Workers Biomonitoring Collaborative, the office workers who were intended to be the controls for the firefighter participants ended up advocating for new purchasing rules to reduce flame retardants in office furnishings. And we've seen many instances of communities where individuals use their own PFAS results on social media to engage elected officials to change policies. Our newest outcome research is an experiment conducted with about 300 women and now in their 50s who are in the Child Health and Development Studies daughters cohort. About 40% of them are Black women. And so we randomized them to half receive their personal results using the report that you've been seeing in my slides, along with aggregate study results. And half of the people initially received only the study-wide results, and we interviewed them both before and after. And then after the post-interview, we returned the personal results to the other group. So we found the participants who received their personal results spent twice as long reading their reports. So returning personal results really creates a bigger opportunity to increase environmental health literacy. People spent more time reading their reports. We found that in the personal report group, nearly everyone spent long enough reading their report to read all of their personal headlines, and 84% clicked through to more details. I'm going to walk you through this quickly so we'll have time for questions. Participants generally reported positive feelings both before and after receiving their personal reports. Here you see strong feelings are at the top, not having the feeling or very mild is at the bottom. The pre-test is on my left, the post-test on the right. So here you see that the positive feelings, curious, informed, interested, empowered, and respected, were in the moderate to very strong range, both before and after receiving reports. Negative feelings, helpless, scared, worried, were generally, most people did not experience these either before or after they got their report. We did see some increase in worry, and that's not necessarily a bad thing in public health. You want people to have a realistic motivation to take action. Among Black participants, the increased worry levels were associated with high exposures. And we hope that will be a lesson for researchers, like a motivation for researchers to engage with their Black participants and Black communities to address these higher exposures that they're experiencing. We have a new study that we hope will begin soon that is collaborating with the ERGO study and PROTECT to integrate report back into clinical studies and engage clinicians as part of the report back team. And this is a very extensive collaboration with Silent Spring Institute, Northeastern, and Rachel Morello Frosch at UC Berkeley, the Harvard Computer Science Department, and many studies. We're very, very grateful for the studies who have partnered with us. And publications from this work are on our website, and we hope you'll visit there.
Great, thank you both. It's really good to hear about the report back and the research to see its effectiveness. Couple questions that have come in. First, do you have any recommended resources to give to IRBs that are initially hesitant to return results?
Well, we have a report back handbook that you can find on the Silent Spring website. And, you know, it's a very official looking document. It's got lots of great work that it represents, and it shows lots of graphs. We often find when we tell IRBs that national academies have recommended this, and a number of other governmental and international bodies have recommended report back as almost required, if not required, that can help sway them. But I think that the more researchers who do this and the more that federal funding agencies push this, the more IRBs will respond.
Yeah, there's a 2018 National Academies report that I particularly recommend. It recommends that a personal report back be the default, basically, in biomonitoring studies.
Great, thank you. This participant said, we are looking for a way to provide results to our participants like Derby. Is it an open source software? If not, what do you recommend for projects that can't afford it but still want to return individual results with context?
Well, it's sort of open source, but we're improving it all the time. So we're in a hand-holding mode with using Derby right now. The intention of creating Derby was that it wouldn't be very expensive. So I would encourage people to get in touch with us and see if we can work it out.
And this question, Julia, do you feel using personalized communication to be more effective than a community meeting approach for communicating environmental health issues to the public?
I would be for both rather than one or the other. We've found that returning personal reports in the context of a community meeting is particularly effective. In PROTECT, reports are being returned in small group meetings of participants. And in the green housing study, which was in public housing, we also returned reports at community meetings. So I wouldn't go with either or, I would go with both.
And two other things to add to that. In our community meetings in Richmond, we were able to bring together lots of people outside of the participants. And that was a community that had historically been very well organized around many things. But it really gave them a much better vehicle to share their experiences with the refinery, with local and state government. And, you know, we were able to share there the aggregate results with people who were not participants as well. The other thing that's interesting, Elizabeth Hoover writes about this in her book, The River is in Us, which is a study that looks at the health studies in the Akwesasne Mohawk community. And she found there that people actually preferred community type meetings. They call them family meetings, where they would invite family and friends to a home, even more than just one-on-one individual report back. So I think when you learn from the community that you're involved with, it also changes the shape of what the report back looks like.
Yeah, the many participants have asked for opportunities to talk together. And in some studies that aren't place-based, they've arranged Zoom meetings so people can engage with each other. I think the combination of personal and community report back is also going to be important for enabling people to take community level action, as it was in our California study.
Are there strategies you would recommend for engaging communities with environmental monitoring report back as opposed to biomonitoring data?
Yeah, Derby can handle any medium. So we've done report back on water, air, soil. It works for that as well as for blood and urine. Yes. I showed an example from the STEEP Superfund project, which has drinking water results in it. Our website has some example reports where you can see different media. The Green Housing Study had urine, air, and dust. So in those situations, you want people to be able to see relationships between those different findings.
How do you approach results that are not clinically actionable or their significance isn't well researched, but participants have still expressed curiosity? Do you still return and risk misinterpretation?
All of our reports are focused primarily on chemicals that don't have clinical action guidelines. Our research is, Silent Spring is focused on breast cancer. So we're studying endocrine disrupting compounds and mammary gland carcinogens. Chemicals and consumer products. So that's our meat and potatoes, is chemicals that don't have any clinical guidelines. And the National Academy's 2018 report addresses that. We have found that people do want their results. They do understand the uncertainties, and that's part of the contextual information, is to say, where are we in the science? What do we know? What don't we know about these chemicals? So in the example of PFAS, we have human studies, we have some animal and cell studies, and we can communicate that to our participants.
And not only that, but this type of work that we're doing, this kind of household exposure and biomonitoring work, both by scientists, but also by community groups that have done some very small sample sizes going back to the Environmental Working Group's original report. These have spurred so much research that has brought us further down the road to knowing more about the direct connections epidemiologically. So whenever we've encountered criticisms like, this is not like lead, this is not like arsenic, you can't make any statements about it, you know, we think that those are really in a way, assaults on good science, because this is how you develop it incrementally.
Thank you. Well, we are just about at time, and those were the questions that came in. So I think we will go ahead and move to our next speakers. Thank you very much, Dr. Bird and Dr. Brown. Fantastic presentations. So next up, we will hear from Dr. Kathleen Gray, a research associate professor and the community engagement core leader at the University of Carolina at Chapel Hill SRP Center. She is joined by Sarah Yelton, the Research Translation Coordinator, UNC SRP Center, and Megan Rogers, a Research Translation Associate at the Center. Dr. Gray, Ms. Yelton, and Ms. Rogers, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. We're excited to talk to you this afternoon, and I'm going to start, and then I'll hand off to Sarah and Megan. I would first like to just start by recognizing the First Peoples of North Carolina. Our university sits on the land of the Okanichi, Shikori, Eno, and Sissipahaw peoples, and we acknowledge and give thanks to them and their descendants. We also acknowledge and give thanks to the enslaved people who built this university and to their descendants. So I want to start, we titled this presentation, How Do We Stop This Exposure? Because this for us is really a framing for a lot of the risk communication we do. We are in partnership with various community-based organizations, and you can see here on the left some of our community partners who came to us with concerns about a large coal ash storage impoundment in their community that was contaminating groundwater, and they said, how do we stop this exposure? We need data. We need the university's help to understand what we're being exposed to and to develop a response that protects health and the environment. And so we really try to center our work around the concerns of the communities who are most directly impacted by contamination. So today we're going to talk from the point of reference of the Superfund research program where the three of us sit, and I'll say more about that in a minute. And we're going to talk about three different environmental exposure areas that we've worked in. We're going to share with you, because NIEHS and EPA told us that a lot of folks on the call today are in state and local government, we're really focusing on our process, how we first hear about risks, and then how we develop communications materials. So we're going to show you some bad examples and hope that the end point is a better example, so you see what it looks like. And we're also going to contrast longer term and more urgent communication. So just quickly, the Superfund research program at UNC, our mission is developing solutions to reduce inorganic arsenic exposure and to prevent arsenic-induced metabolic disease. So we have three biomedical research projects focused on that theme and two environmental science projects. And then we have the research translation and community engagement expertise centered in cores that support the research projects. So Sarah Yelton, who will speak in a little bit, is our research translation core coordinator, and I am the community engagement core leader, and Megan also is a part of the research translation team. So these are resources that exist in every Superfund research program. So if there is an SRP near you, there are resources just like all of us who've spoken this afternoon who may be available to help you address your risk communication needs. So here at UNC, our approach, I was trying to think about the easiest way to describe the process. So I divided it into three buckets. And I would say first is to be responsive. So as I said, we are part of a network of community engaged organizations. We have a couple paid community partners. So they're organizations we've done a lot of work with, and they are part of our Superfund research program, Clean Water for North Carolina, and the Winyo Rivers Alliance, which is home to the Lumber River Keeper. So those are two organizations we work closely with, but we have networks across the state that we have worked with on various environmental health issues. And so we're in dialogue with through stakeholder advisory boards and also just with our daily work. And when people bring needs to us, especially where we see that the expertise of UNC can come to bear and shed light on questions, you know, we're always excited to have those conversations and engage. And then that next phase of engaging, really there, I mean, engage more broadly. So we're actively in dialogue with our community partners. But then when someone like Caroline comes and says, we have a concern, and we need help researching this exposure, we then reach out to the local health departments and state and local government and other advocates in the community who might be working on an issue and who might have perspectives. And importantly, with risk communication, as we heard from the folks at UW, we try to engage the intended audience in any ultimate risk communication. So sometimes a community-based or a community-serving organization raises a concern, but they aren't the ultimate audience. And if they're not, we really try to make sure that the intended audience is engaged in the dialogue. And then we enter into the creativity phase, which is an iterative process. We draft something, we try to assess it, we revise it, and we repeat. And that can sometimes be a very short repetition. And sometimes you have to go through a lot of cycles, and it is often dependent on time and money, how much you can iterate. In these last two buckets is where we also have a chance to do qualitative research. And I appreciated Phil and Julia really giving us a lot of detail about the amazing research they've done with Derby. But it is an opportunity also in partnership with universities when there are questions where we don't know what the answer is and we're not sure the best way to communicate. We have opportunities to really interrogate that a bit together and see what we can learn. So I will kick off one of our examples, and that's in the fish consumption realm. The environmental exposure of concern here were PCBs and also mercury, because we have a statewide mercury advisory in North Carolina. So we have a local recreational reservoir, Lake Crabtree, that has been contaminated by a nearby Superfund site. And Sarah, in this picture on the left, this is her at one of the tributaries talking to a group of teachers. So for several years, we did teacher professional development around the Superfund site and the issue of local contamination. And as a result of that work, we became really closely connected with the park staff and also with the local river keeper. And so here in the middle, you see the park manager and you can see the river keeper, both of whom came to me with concerns that in their daily work, they were seeing people consuming fish from this reservoir. And I meant to say that there is a catch and release policy there. So while you can catch all the fish you want, you're supposed to throw them back, and they should not be consumed based on the contamination levels that have been identified in the fish. So they were encountering lots of people fishing, including subsistence fishers who were eating the fish. And they were concerned about how to better communicate about the advisories. So together we convened, first it was sort of a small group of park staff and some of the advocates to think about what we could do better. And then that group grew actually to include other universities, and NC State became an important partner in this work, and also other people, including business people who own bait shops, and, you know, so people who are involved in fishing from many different angles. But in this small working group, we did not have anglers who were impacted by that lake, by the contamination in that lake. So you can also see up here in the corner, this is a UNC student who's interviewing anglers. We did some work similar to the work described by UW, where we actually surveyed people fishing at the lake to see what they knew about the advisory, what kind of fish they were catching, and what their risk perceptions were. Anyway, through this work, we really realized that we weren't getting the perspective of the subsistence fishers. And so we then conducted qualitative research with subsistence fishers. And you can see some of that work being shown down here in the corner, where we sought input on materials that we were developing and just sought to understand what did they take away from the materials, how did they perceive them, and also how fishing was part of their daily lives and subsistence. So I said I'll show you some good and some bad examples. So here we were focused on signs in this research, because signs are the most common way that fish consumption advisories are communicated, and they are low cost. So sometimes it's all a municipality can do to erect a sign. And if all you're going to do is a sign, it better be a good sign. I will say, as a result of our research, we recommended multi-pronged communication, not just signs. But I'm focused on signs right now. So this is the sign that was at the waterside. Doesn't draw your attention. There are words like PCBs that aren't explained. I would say it's not the best example. Well, here's a second example, and this should show you why you don't just want a group of scientists sitting around designing communication. So here I could take a few minutes, which I won't do, and tell you why the literature source that suggested every dimension of the sign that you see right here. So everything on this sign was based on current literature about what's effective in communicating fish consumption advisories. But I think we could probably all agree it's not a great example of communication. Nevertheless, we took this with the fishermen and we asked questions like, what's important to you on this sign? What's the main message of this sign? What's confusing about it? And the end product looked more like this. And a couple key things here, we really zeroed in on who are the most vulnerable populations, made sure we had pictures. We did go back and forth about to what extent to highlight the health benefits of fish versus just focusing on the fish you can't eat, related to the prior question that came up. But with a sign, you have a little bit of time and a little bit of landscape. So we really tried to focus on a core message. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Sarah.
Thank you, Kathleen. As Kathleen mentioned at the beginning, the Well Empowered Project, which is one that concerns toxic metals contamination in private wells in North Carolina, began as a response to community need for data, particularly about exposures to these metals in private well water, as well as assistance in making sense of data that they had already received around this particular issue. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. This was all precipitated by the third largest coal ash spill in US history happening on the Dan River in 2014, where 39,000 tons of coal ash and 27 million gallons of ash pond water were released into the river. As part of the Coal Ash Management Act that came to bear after that spill, a groundwater assessment was conducted on all water supply wells within 1,500 feet of coal-powered facilities boundaries in North Carolina. And this included a few of the residents around the Belews Creek Steam Station in Walnut Cove, which is about 30 miles upstream from the site of that large spill. We were connected with community members in Walnut Cove, including Caroline Armijo, who Kathleen quoted earlier, and they reached out at the time to UNCSRP, to our community engagement core, and asked us to help them better understand what was going on. What were the risks from these coal ash ponds that were in their community? And they also had environmental injustice concerns because the Belews Creek Steam Station and the associated coal ash impoundments are located in an area of the county with significantly higher proportion of African American residents than are in the surrounding areas. So in conversation, we heard from those who did get their well tested during that state groundwater assessment that they didn't really understand the results that they were getting. They were confused. They weren't sure what actions to take. And from those who didn't get their wells tested, they wanted to know, well, what's going on with me? Some of my neighbors are getting tested, but not everybody. So help us, as Caroline said, with the data. We need some evidence. So next slide, please, Kathleen. So working with Dr. Rebecca Fry, who is currently the director of our UNC SRP and her team, as well as our colleague, Dr. Andrew George, and with lots of input from community residents, we developed a sampling plan that originally included well samples and first draw samples from a tap in the house that also residents were concerned about potential contamination from premise plumbing. That's why we had those two samples. As we continued developing this plan and getting ready to go out and start sampling, some residents were also revealing concern about potential soil contamination given their proximity to these coal ash impoundments. So we revised the sampling plan at that point, and you can see one of our UNC students in, who is part of Dr. Fry's lab over on the right, digging soil that we also were taking samples of at the time from gardens, from play spaces. Really, we asked the residents to direct us to places that they were concerned about. So having all of the soil and water bringing back to UNC, handling the analysis, we realized our next challenge was going to be sharing the results in a way that reduced confusion instead of increasing it, and supported the community residents in understanding what was in their well water and soil so they could make evidence-based decisions on how to best protect their health. The next slide, please, Kathleen. So as an example of communications that are quite common here in North Carolina and probably in your states as well from certified labs or public health labs, residents were getting huge tables with lots of different potential contaminants. They were being described in terms of micrograms per liter, which was not as familiar to everyone who was reading these reports. They were reporting on both the federal maximum contaminant level and our state groundwater standards. And then the results over on the side. And there's not a really clear way to tell at a glance, am I at risk? What can I get out of this without delving in a lot deeper? So if you'll click through, We were inspired by the report back materials that Monica Ramirez-Andriotta and the Garden Roots team at University of Arizona had been producing. And similar to what Julia was sharing earlier with Derby, this more graphical representation to share information about exceedances was a way we thought that we could improve on what folks had been receiving prior to our coming to us. So we used this graph to be able to share those results in relation to the relevant standard. In the case of arsenic, we were reporting based on the EPA MCL. And I think if you click through again, Kathleen, you can see we also were sharing information about both their well sample and the sample of water that came from their house. So trying to share information about differences there, really calling out if they were exceeding a particular contaminant level. And we noticed that in follow-up surveys that when residents were able to compare their results to a bright red line, like you see here with the EPA MCL, that helped them to be able to think about the types of actions they wanted to be able to take. We also had contaminants where we may have been reporting a state groundwater standard or a health protect or health guidance level that was set by our Department of Health and Human Services. And in some cases, multiple standards in one graph. And that became more confusing for residents, as you can imagine. So they want to know, where's the bright red line? Where do I take action? And we all know that there's a level of uncertainty that's hard to communicate and is a challenge in thinking about how much information to share so that people can to make those decisions for themselves. One other thing, we did make an adjustment to talk about parts per billion on in trying to help people understand what was going on in the graph and making those connections to the earlier results they might have seen, but that was still an area where we saw room for improvement. So next slide, please, Kathleen. We also, as Julia mentioned earlier, we wanted to be able to share results from the individual personal level, but also in the context of the community. So we had printed these results for individuals. They received a packet and we did that on paper because of internet access in this rural area. It just wasn't, we weren't sure we could rely on that and people being able to access their results that way. So we also shared in a community meeting, a summary of everybody that was in their particular area. Next slide, please, Kathleen. So that experience, that pilot project, as always happens, raised lots of questions for us. Like, what can we do better? How we felt like we had improved on what had been out there before, and follow-up surveys told us that we were doing pretty well, but there were still some areas where we could make improvement. So to that end, Kathleen and others in our group, in partnership with the University of Arizona and University of Kentucky, designed a research study to better understand not only where there might be knowledge gaps that prevent someone from taking health protective actions, but also potential gaps in their skills and knowing what to do and how to do it, and their sense of self-efficacy for taking action. So for this study, a scenario of a well contaminated with arsenic was shared with study participants who included undergraduates at a public university and residents of areas impacted by well contamination. And you can see some changes here to how that information was communicated. And findings from this study showed that all participants were able to understand the results as they were presented, and they were able to determine if it was okay to drink the water based on this scenario that was presented. And from the self-efficacy survey, interestingly, cost of the well test and distance to the well testing facility were factors that really influenced participants' self-efficacy. So now we're excited to be moving into thinking about how to apply these findings in upcoming well testing campaigns here in North Carolina. So now I'd like to turn it over to Megan Rogers, who's going to share our work around PFAS communication, which is a little more urgent communication, as she will tell you.
Thanks, Sarah and Kathleen. So as Sarah mentioned, I'm now going to talk about more urgent communication required for relaying test results. As she mentioned, this is part of the NCPFAS testing network, which I'll describe on the next slide. But for this project, our role was more strictly communication based rather than community engagement, like the work that Kathleen and Sarah described earlier. We were tasked with communicating urgent results in efficient ways, and therefore it was more necessary to work quickly with communities to share study findings and develop this risk messaging. So through this iterative process of sharing results with the community, we learned from the best practices. And in the end, we were able to use this experience as an example with researchers and trainees from the network to emphasize the importance of gathering input from both researchers and communication experts to provide the right messages. Can you click forward, Kathleen? And so this is just one example of kind of part of the iterative process, kind of showing using colors and the line of exceedance that Sarah mentioned from our other projects, just, you know, one step in the process of getting the best kind of message for the community audience. Next slide, please. Okay, so as I mentioned, I would talk briefly about the PFAS network just to give you a clue of what I'm talking about here. The NC PFAS testing network is a statewide research collaboration that was formed to test for current levels of PFAS chemicals in drinking water and in air samples across North Carolina. The network team is comprised of principal investigators from many universities in North Carolina, including UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, ECU, NC A&T, UNC Wilmington, UNC Charlotte, and Duke. And they all received NC General Assembly funding through the NC Policy Collaboratory. The communications team specifically was co-led by researchers from UNC, Duke, and NC State. And our goal and initiative was a collaborative effort between the three institutions, each bringing their own strengths to the team to respond to community identified needs while engaging community partners, scientists, and the intended audiences in the network's activities. The communications team also hosted multiple events ranging from community forums and webinars to symposia. Next slide, please. So the quick urgent communication I was talking about two slides ago, we were able to use this example as a learning tool for the network during a science communication training that we hosted for researchers and trainees that were part of the network. Some of the researchers from the network already have a good grasp of communicating their science, whereas others haven't had as much experience. And so the training was a good way to share our expertise with the group and get feedback on how they could use these communication tools in their presentations and also learn from each other. So we received feedback from community leaders that many of the researchers were using chemical structures in their presentations, which were confusing for some of the community members. And we asked the researchers what they were trying to convey by using these graphics. And they said that they wanted their audiences to understand the similarities between the chemical structures that they were sharing. And they wanted to show that the bonds in human-made chemical structures were very strong. So we explained to the researchers that these structures, using so many of them, was very confusing for some of the community audiences. And we asked if they could instead convey these ideas using fewer chemical structures and or using analogies as well. So this was an iterative process between us and the researchers to eventually come to an understanding that was both beneficial for the researchers and the community audiences that they were presenting to. Next slide. So in addition to that process with the chemical structures, many of the researchers were also using complex graphics in their presentation, like the one you see on the slide here. And so we once again asked, you know, what they were trying to convey by using these graphics. And, you know, a couple of the researchers we talked to would point to one tiny piece of the graphic and say that that was like, you know, what they were trying to convey. Yet they have the entire graphic on the slide with lots of, you know, confusing words, lots of confusing lines and detail that's unnecessary. So in response, we worked with a UNC student who had expertise in communications and via her practicum was able to create some graphics that more clearly communicated about PFAS in the environment. And this is one example here. We'll share a couple more on the next slide. But once again, this was an iterative process with the researchers going back and forth to make sure that our graphics were as accurate as possible with the least amount of details needed to share the point that we were coming, that we were trying to get across. And so we had to use this process to make sure that they were getting exactly what they needed in the graphic, and we were maintaining simplicity so that these graphics could be used with all different kinds of audiences. I'd also like to note that the communication graphics can always be improved, and we feel these graphics we've created are a dramatic improvement from the examples that we were finding when we tried to provide alternatives for the researchers in the network to use in their presentations. So we tried looking for scientifically accurate yet concise graphics and couldn't really find any on PFAS, and so we started kind of creating our own. And next slide, please. So showing just a few more examples, as I mentioned, all of these graphics were vetted by both researchers and community audiences so that we were ensuring that we could help convey the research that was coming out of the network. Click forward again. And so I didn't mention, but the network had many different teams of research studying many different topics. So we tried to make sure our graphics touched on all those different kinds of research. So we also had graphics on human health, and also graphics that linked to animal studies as well, just to show kind of what PFAS exposure can do in the human body and also what it's proven to do in animal studies. So not only could the researchers use these graphics in their presentations, but we also made sure that they could be printed as well. So we have versions that are in image files, as well as versions that have kind of a little bit of additional context and can be printed from PDF files as well. And so these were created a couple of years ago, but we continue to receive requests from people at other universities and other organizations who want to use these presentations, use these images in their presentations and on their websites. All right, I'll turn it back to Kathleen.
Thanks, Megan. This is our last slide, and I just wanted to summarize some of what we shared. So in our work, bringing together research translation and community engagement in the SRP at UNC, our existing community relationships are critical, and they are really what enable us to be responsive to developing environmental health issues. And we are privileged to call the community-based organizations we work with our collaborators. We also, I think, talked about how we needed varied expertise in these processes. And I don't mean by that, I don't mean it in the typical academic sense of different departments at the university, but we needed that community expertise. We needed the insights of the intended audiences, and we did draw on lots of different expertise within the university. And then, as Megan just said, the final draft is rarely final. So you're usually limited by money or time, how many iterations you can do. But no matter how many you do and how proud you feel of the final product, almost the next day, you'll hear from someone who says, you know, you could have done this differently. And so we try to, whenever we can, just continue developing products, much like you heard Julia talking about with all those really cool new Derby products. And last thing I want to say is something I said at the beginning. There is a network across the country of Superfund research programs and also of other NIEHS-funded centers that have resources focused on community engagement, research translation, science communication. So for those of you who are not at universities and who are out across the country, we are always looking for partners, and we can be a referral resource to other universities if it's something you're trying to address is not in our area of expertise. There are certainly other institutions that could address it. And so with that, I just want to recognize all of the people who contributed to the work that we shared with you, including some of the partners we have in the SRP network. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you all. That was excellent information and really wonderful visuals. There is one question about if those visuals are available online, and they really like that you got community feedback in the development, or how do people get access to those?
So if the question is specifically about the PFAS visuals, those are online at the website that Megan shared. Maybe we can pop that into the chat. They are available, and we get requests for, we've been getting a lot of requests for them from across the country, and they are freely available to be used. And then other graphics, I would say if there was something in particular you were interested in, people should feel free to reach out to me, and maybe we could also just reinsert my email address in the chat. Then I'd be happy to respond to any requests for visuals.
Great. I have a question. What are your recommendations for leveraging community collaborations to resolve conflicts between government science and citizen science results or conclusions?
Could you say that? I didn't hear the last part, Zamia.
Sure. What are the recommendations for leveraging community collaborations to resolve conflicts between government science and then citizen science results?
Oh, that's a good question. Sarah is our resident citizen science expert, so she might want to start.
Yeah, you know, the groups that I have worked with, I think it's a great question and one that we continue to wrestle with in the community science or citizen science world. One where groups that I have worked with have been able to use community science findings to bring issues to the attention of government scientists or regulators to say, hey, here is something that we are seeing. We think that there is an opportunity to investigate further if water quality results, for example, are not, they're not using the same techniques that are required by whichever regulatory agency. But it's a way to point them to a place where we might need a little more investigation. So that's, I don't have the answer. I wish that we did, but I think it's going to take a lot as community science and citizen science projects become more a part of what we are doing, that we'll be able to wrestle with some of these questions and hopefully have some good conversation about how to help those collaborations move forward.
Okay. One person asked, why don't you consider setting up a fish exchange program? And I think this is while you were presenting, Dr. Gray. I'm not familiar with what that is. So if you know, if you could explain it.
I'm not sure that I know either what a fish exchange program is. So I would ask that questioner to say a little bit more, because I'd be happy to talk about fish.
Okay, great. Yeah, if that person could put more in the chat, that would be great for the Q&A. One question I had was, were the researchers, when you're doing the training, were the researchers open to creating, you know, their presentations in more lay language or clear writing?
Well, I'll speak to that. So just like all of us, right, there's a spectrum of readiness and openness. So we are lucky that we've worked with some incredible scientists, Rebecca Fry, Detlef Canapi, Jamie DeWitt, or just a few who come to mind, who are great communicators and who helped develop those trainings. Then maybe there are other folks who won't get named, who aren't quite as far along in the skills scenario. And some of them really are aware of that and are aware that there's a scientific language that's different from our daily language, and they want to be able to, you know, be in both places. And then some people just don't know. And a challenge, I would say, for Superfund centers who are all trying to do this work to make the science communication more effective, is that the younger scientists tend to be most open to it. And they are usually coming in with some decently developed communication skills, thanks to social media. So so I will ask us all to look in the mirror and ask and think about, are you the person who needs to be open? Because I think we could all improve our science communication. I learn something every time I go to a science communication workshop, and I think I'm a decent science communicator. So we can all learn and grow. And it is challenging when people don't recognize that they are cutting off the potential for collaboration and communication by standing behind the barrier that their scientific language can create.
Thank you, we'll put. How do you ensure that you're hearing about issues that aren't on your radar or hearing from groups you may not already be connected to?
Did one of you want to take that? Okay, I will. I think we're lucky again that we've been doing this work for a long time, so that we, as I mentioned earlier, we have a stakeholder advisory board, as most SRPs do. We have some dedicated community partners who know the workings of the institution well, and so know how to navigate things that can be off-putting to people who don't partner with academia a lot. But then our staff, our community engagement and translation staff, are going out and participating in community meetings. And when we hear that there are environmental justice concerns or issues where maybe we've gotten sort of a referral from a current partner, we do try to go and be present and think about how we can serve. Since we're a public institution, that's really part of our mission, how we can be of service. And if we can't, how maybe one of our partner institutions who's closer to a community can be. So especially for those of us that are public institutions, we are here. Part of the science is about discovery, and part of the science is about solving real world problems that are present in our communities today. And so I think for people who are outside academia trying to connect with academia, public institutions have that at their core. And so just keep asking and you'll find the people whose job it is to stand up and say, yes, we're building those bridges.
Well, thank you. It is time to wrap up our webinar today. So thank you all for your presentations. Really appreciate your work. And put my notes. So with that, it is time to conclude today's session, the last in this webinar series. You can view a recorded archive of the first two sessions online, and a recording from the third session and today's session will be available soon. And I'm sorry, Molly, I realize I missed a couple slides. I'm gonna go back to slide 9. But before we conclude, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for our speakers, and a link to our feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to visit the SRP RISC e-learning webpage and subscribe to the RISC e-learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. You can also follow SRP on Twitter. Let's see, so I'll just repeat what I said before. With that, it's time to conclude today's session, the last in the series. You can review the recorded archive online from the first two sessions. The third session and today's session will be available soon. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we will pass those along to the presenters who can follow up. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. I would like to sincerely thank our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.